This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Came across an interesting little sign today on the social medias, work-related sign. Evidently, the Golden Arch place, the place with the big M, you know what it is, yellow M out on the street corner, they're all over the place. Takes, you know, billions of dollars in federal money to support a workforce that they underpay, that they overwork, under schedule, you know, all that stuff. Saw this interesting sign, caught my attention, thought, man, this gets me. Evidently, the big M says, we value you. Your growth and your contributions. We value you. But we're not going to pay you. We're not going to give you health care, you know, retirement security. We're not going to help you make this, you know, something you can live off of. No. We're not going to do that. But hey, we'll, like the pandemic, we'll give you nice names, shiny little badges for your uniform, you know, all that stuff. We'll do the, you know, the pats on the back, pats on the head, you know, that stuff. But the sign in big bold letters says, in red too, it's a big stop sign. This is a no quit restaurant. This is what they're saying. So no quit restaurant, no quitting, not allowed to quit. And they go on to say, because we feel that many situations can be resolved. It is the policy of the restaurant that an employee cannot quit until he or she talks to the restaurant management or area supervisor. Now, I mean, if you really want to quit, you know, two words could really make that, you know, pretty simple. You know, there's a giant, you know what I'm saying. There's a way, you know, to, but that wouldn't be a quit. That'd be a fire, and that would be insubordination, and that would be bad. And I don't believe that. Now, here's the thing. This is the weird thing, because we were just talking about how, you know, in the workplace, you know, workers are finally starting to find some power. I see this sign, and it's one of those things where you go, The only power a worker really has is to fold their arms, put their hands in their pockets, and march their feet. That's all they've got, to withhold their labor. They don't control anything else in the workplace. They don't choose who gets hired or fired. They don't choose any of that stuff. That's the employer. They don't set the terms and the conditions and the working environment. They don't do any of that stuff. Again, that's the employer. They don't dole out work assignments. They don't, you know, they don't set the terms of the day. They don't do any of that. None of it. Now they want you to believe that we'll take your views under advisement. There's a suggestion box out front, and we know what happens when people have suggested things. Think of those workers at Trader Joe's who said, "Hey, we would like better PPE," and they said, "Well, we disagree. You're fired." This is how this game has been played for a very long time, because management has the power to evaluate, set goals, targets, deadlines. They've got all this. They set all of the workplace policies, everything, dress code, code of conduct, use of resources, all of this stuff. And we know this, right? They set whether it's going to be a healthy or a safe workplace. They set whether it's going to be dangerous, and they're going to cut quarters. Workers don't have any say, unless, as I've said, over the years, you have a union to negotiate, to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. But most people understand, in the private sector, only about 6.7%. we'll go 7. Only 7% of the workforce has a union. That means 93% of the people live under a, well, the master-servant relationship. Constantly monitored, constantly surveilled, always under the gun. You know, we're going to discipline you, we'll demote you, you know, all this stuff. And we've seen it, and none of this is new. But this sign really just sent me completely off the deep end, because we've seen this stuff before. They're attempting to limit a worker's ability to move, to move on, to put their hands in their pockets and march to their feet. And this is the kind of stuff we're going to see a lot more of. Trust me, this is coming. There was a state a couple of years ago, if I remember, I think it may have been Illinois, actually, that said that if a teacher wanted to quit, you know, during the year, they might pull her. They're going to pull her teaching certificate, going to pull her license, basically trapping that teacher into that environment. And look, it could be a horrible environment. So the only way that you can get out of that is, well, go in and get yourself fired. And nobody wants to do that. Now, the weird thing, and I keep coming back to this moment, you know, employers have all the power, all of it. And this is the weird thing, because I've had people go, we don't need no union. The benevolent company gives me these wonderful things. And you go, no, the company gives you what little they can give you to maximize their profit off your back. It's called capitalism. Maybe you've heard of it. It's how this works. But what they like to do is they like to strengthen their position. Think of non-competes. In certain very isolated instances where you're talking about highly technical, you know, patented kind of stuff, you know, the proprietary information that a company may have hold in their secret vault. If someone were to go to a competitor with that information, you go, okay, I can see that. But a sandwich shop, I'm sorry, you may remember this. There was a sandwich shop, it was Jimmy John's, that had people signing non-competes to where they literally couldn't walk across the street, or they wanted their employees to believe they couldn't walk across the street and make a peanut butter jelly sandwich. Now, you know, none of this stuff would hold up in court, but how many working people have the ability to, well, fight it? How many people know that they even signed it? And this is the thing that keeps me going back to, you need representation. And I think this is why we're seeing, you know, a lot of interest right now. Because, you know, it got me thinking about the history of, you know, labor's history and where we've come from. The old yellow dog contracts, you may have heard that. You know, 80, 90 years ago, employer would make you sign a yellow dog contract. It was a contract that said, if you ever joined a union, you would be fired immediately. You know, even if you showed any interest in joining, you'd be fired immediately. Now, the Supreme Court eventually ruled that unconstitutional. But understand, the employer still thinks, they think you may, because they don't want any infringement on their power. And I started thinking about, you know, the history of the employee-employer relationship. And, you know, here, like I've said a million times, here in Pennsylvania, the workers' comp law still refers to master and servant. There's still that mentality that once you walk across that threshold, once you are on the clock, your behind is theirs. You do what they say, when they say, how they say, where they say, all of that stuff. You have basically sold yourself. And, you know, I started thinking about forced arbitration clauses that are now, you know, the norm in every employment contract, in every employment situation. And again, most people don't even know they're signing this stuff. On the first day of work, they give you a whole bunch of things. Here, sign your life away. You want a job, don't you? Here, sign your life away. And people sign it without actually thinking about what kind of more power you're giving to these employers. And it got me coming back to this pendulum swing that we've been living through over the last 40 years. You know, Dan, you know, sent me an email just a few minutes before the show and said, hey, it's time to crush and reverse Reaganomics. I've been a union member in various unions, and I've lived through Reaganomics my entire life, and it sucks. Reagan totally screwed the unions and the middle class. Unfortunately, they named an interstate after that blank hole, which I have to drive on a lot. It really makes him mad. Different phrase. But here's the thing, that pendulum swing that Dan is talking about, this move from, you know, the FDR era of, we want to encourage strong unions, we want to encourage, you know, high tax rates to ensure that, you know, that you don't have a handful of extraordinarily powerful people, and breaking up of conglomerates and you know, competition and all of those things that, you know, built the most prosperous working class in history. Reagan tore all that stuff down. Neoliberalism destroyed all of that stuff. Supply side voodoo Reaganomics, all of it gone. And in its place, tax cuts for the very wealthy, tax cuts for big corporation, consolidation and monopolization. And look, you know, Democrats were on board with this too. You know, Clinton was, you know, a neoliberal right there. And I remember back in the 90s talking to some union friends, union leaders at the time, and railing against neoliberals. And, you know, quietly they would go, hey, you know, some of our friends are neoliberals. And you go, no, they're not our friends. They are ruining this country. They are destroying communities. They are taking jobs out of this. Free trade was a disaster. And the reason I bring this up is we're in a moment right now where we've got a guy in the White House who remembers that era. Now you can go, well, you know, he voted for all that stuff. And he did. He was sold. He drank some of the Kool-Aid and went along with it. Now he's the guy. He's in charge. He's got the mantle. And look what he's been doing. Taking on China, reshoring manufacturing, investing in infrastructure, talking about increasing taxes, getting the rich to pay what they should be paying. And look, he's not even talking about where I'm at. I think we should be taxing billionaires out of existence. It is no good for our country. We should be breaking up big corporations. We should be encouraging competition. You know, what capitalism was supposed to be. We're in a moment where that sainted Ronald Reagan and the views of, you know, supply side voodoo Reaganomics is finally, people are waking up and go, it didn't work. Nothing trickled down to the working class. Because our 1%, their insatiable appetite for more never ends. So when Dan sends this email, I know hundreds of people like Dan who are tired of working their behinds off, busting their behind day after day, only to come up short, only to not be able to do as well as their parents and their grandparents. And that's why I think we're in this moment. And corporate America understands. Corporate America sees what's going on, which is why, you know, they want to take away. This is a no-quit zone. What the? Are you kidding me? But they're going to try because they can. And this is where it comes back to us. It comes back to working people saying enough is enough. It comes back to enough of us going, we're not going to take it. We're not going to tolerate this behavior anymore. To me, it seems like it's about time. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Would you walk in and say, you know what? Would you go through that? It's a no-quit zone. You okay with that? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So this is a story that got, you know, I don't think got a lot of attention. And you wonder why Ron DeSantis is not doing well in the polls. Evidently, he has rejected about almost $400 million in federal energy funds to fuel efficiency rebates, electrification, all part of the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act. There's a bunch of stuff out there to help people, you know, transition into more fuel efficient stuff, to electric, you know, whatever. And again, this is where you want to take advantage of it. You should be able to. The governor is saying, no, we're not going to take it. We're not going to take almost $400 million in funds to help. Help do anything on the climate. Nothing. Head in the sand. Complete denial. No problem in Florida. There's no problem in Florida. And it got me thinking about it. You know, this guy on TikTok, angry old guy, uses the F word a lot. Talking about how, you know, there's no such thing as global warming. If there were, you know, there'd be no banks writing, you know, mortgages. There'd be no insurance companies insuring anything. Well... I bring this up for a reason, because we are farmers. Da, 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 da. Evidently, farmers is the canary in the coal mine, because I think they're going to be the first. Understand, Florida is, you know, when climate changes and Florida's underwater, they eventually will come begging for federal dollars, even though they didn't take any federal dollars to help not let it happen. They will at some point. Now, what's interesting, you know, before I get into farmers, Florida has home insurance rates that are like 3-4 times the national average. I saw one story said around $6,000 a year for homeowners insurance in Florida, when the national average is about $1,700. I saw another story that said it was, you know, somewhere around $4,300 when the national average is $1,500. Doesn't matter. Florida is paying incredibly high insurance rates. Now, what happens is most people can't afford it, so they're left out in the cold. They don't insure their homes. And when a disaster comes through, you know, they're looking with their hand out to the federal government. So, you know, California, Pennsylvania, New York, you know, Michigan, all these states then kick in federal money that goes to these people who couldn't afford the insurance, but still got wiped out anyway. So DeSantis, again, not taking the money to help, you know, do anything on the climate front, has done virtually nothing here. Well, that's not true. Not true. He's not that he's done virtually nothing. He's done quite a bit taking insurance industry money to stop any kind of, you know, homeowner revolt, homeowners suing insurance companies when they don't pay. You know, it's money well spent. Now, the reason I brought up, you know, we are farmers, da 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 da. The reason I brought them up, they're leaving Florida. They are no longer going to write new policies or renew existing homeowner, auto, and umbrella policies. It's going to affect about 100,000 people in Florida. And, you know, the Florida guy who oversees the insurance, the chief financial officer, he ain't happy. And he says that he's going to hold them accountable. And you go, wait a second, as long as they live out the term of their contract and, you know, they end it within the law and all that, there's nothing you can do. It's called capitalism. Maybe you've heard of it. It's a contract. You signed it. You paid for a certain amount of time. That's what happens. That's how the game is played. And what farmers are saying is, look, you know, we're not losing money. And what I find interesting is, and I was thinking about this as, you know, my son and I are learning to ride motorcycles. You know, if my son were to have, you know, multiple accidents, with speeding tickets, you know, you name it, you know, whatever could possibly happen, he would still be able to get insurance. Now, it might cost a lot of money, but he'd still be able to get it, even if it's one of those bottom feeder companies. This is what I expect to see in Florida at some point. The sad reality is they're not doing much to not help the water rise and put Florida underwater. And my mind went to this part where maybe DeSantis needs to build a wall. Maybe DeSantis needs to build a big wall all around Florida. Or maybe we just need to build one right at the top of Florida and go, you know what? We're writing this off. Because blue states have got to, at some point, get tired of funding disaster after disaster when they're not even taking care of themselves. And insurance companies are going to leave in huge numbers, even though Florida is one of those states that has some of the most lax environments for insurance companies. In fact, you know, as this report that I was reading pointed out, that DeSantis signed a piece of legislation that took away the ability of homeowners to recover attorney's fees when they had to sue insurance companies. Because how did it go? It went something along the lines of, you know, these frivolous lawsuits, you know, increase the cost of doing business in Florida. We can't have that because we want to be business friendly. Now, the weird thing is, and this is the other interesting thing, all of this stuff happened under DeSantis's watch. So what is it that made it balloon? Is it that, you know, climate change is finally, you know, doing a lot of things? Insurance companies are wising up, because again, he was sworn in 2019, and it's been this kind of explosion in homeowner insurance rates on his watch. Now, as I said, you know, he signed this piece of legislation, and, you know, he's collected about $4 million in campaign donations from insurance companies. So you kind of got to wonder, should we give him the insurance badge on his NASCAR robe? Now, the weird thing is, for all of the talk about, and all of the talk from DeSantis about, you know, the Florida miracle, and, you know, how we're, you know, the most, you know, the best economy state, I saw that Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach, that whole area down there, their inflation rate right now is 9%. National average is 4%. They're at 9, more than double. And it's because of, you know, insurance, housing prices going through the roof, extraordinarily costly replacement costs when their houses get washed away. And this is one of those things where I keep coming back to. Did you not plan for this? Did you not know for the last 30 years that you're going to need more levies? Did you not know that you were going to maybe need, you know, some way of, I don't know, keeping the water out? And this is one of those moments where I go back to, maybe we stop. Because remember, our capitalist friends, our free market friends, of which our Republican friends do not ascribe, they would say, you know, if you can't afford the insurance, you're SOL. You're out of luck, buddy. So why is it that we taxpayers across this country keep bailing these people out? And look, this is not a new argument. There are people, you know, much smarter than I am who've been going, why are we doing this? Why are we encouraging rich people to build their water? And then when, surprisingly, there's a hurricane and, you know, a tornado, you know, there's all these disasters that we know are going to come, why do we keep rebuilding in the exact same spot to only have it washed away again? Oh, that's right. Because they've got lobbyists and they've got money. Why is it we're using that money to rebuild these palatial estates along the coasts when we could be using that for education? We could be using that for healthcare. We could get them U-Hauls. We could get these people. I say there should be a program, free U-Hauls, for all the people living in Florida so they could gather the sheep and get the flock out. That seems reasonable to me. That seems rational. It's time to go. We're not going to do anything on climate change. We're not going to save the environment. We're not going to do anything for future generations. It's time to, well, save ourselves. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find podcasts, you will find ours. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Botox Cosmetic, out of botulinum toxin A, FDA approved for over 20 years. So, talk to your specialist to see if Botox Cosmetic is right for you.
For full prescribing information, including boxed warning, visit BotoxCosmetic.com or call 877-351-0300.
Remember to ask for Botox Cosmetic by name. To see for yourself and learn more, visit BotoxCosmetic.com. That's BotoxCosmetic.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it's Prime Day. That's right, Amazon Prime Day. You can get your cheap garbage delivered to your door in mind-blowing speed. And it's one of these things where you go, every Prime Day I go, you know, okay, this is great, fine. You're gonna sell stuff at a little bit cheaper to entice people to buy more. I get it. People need their fix of cheap stuff. Because it's what we've been sold for the last 40 years. Give up good wage jobs because, hey, you can still get cheap stuff. But what about the people who bring that cheap stuff? Again, coming out of the pandemic, we're talking about people who we said were heroes. They were essential. They were all those things. But what about those folks who in this blazing July heat are the ones out there making that cheap stuff show up on your door? It's not magic. Someone's got to do it. What kind of deal do they get? Here to share some thoughts on how that's going to work out. I've asked our good friend Randy Corgan to come talk with us. Randy's the Secretary, Treasurer, and Principal Officer at Teamsters Local 1932. Their website, Teamsters1932.org. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, always a pleasure to be on here, and especially on Prime Day. Isn't that amazing?
So Prime Day, magic stuff shows up on our door cheap. It's amazing. It's great. You know, never mind those people who have to, you know, drive in those trucks to bring it. What's going on today?
Well, you know, hundreds of thousands of workers are having to, labor themselves in very difficult situations. I think, as you pointed out, for a very cheap product, and there's a cost to it. What's the cost? And what's the cost of the industry? What's the cost of these workers? What's the cost? What's the exchange here? You get a bunch of stuff for a little bit cheaper on Prime Day over a couple days. And then the system, you know, fills up with all these orders. And, people in the fulfillment centers and the sortation centers and the delivery stations all, you know, get flooded with a tremendous amount of work who are being exploited at an incredibly challenging situations. And I don't think that the average customer realizes that Amazon delivery driver that's showing up at the doorstep is actually, according to Amazon, is not an employee of Amazon, even though they have the uniform, they drive the vehicle, they're utilizing Amazon equipment, and the amount of control which Amazon exerts over those workers and that workforce is a little bit mind-blowing when they say they're not ours, but we want them to look like ours, and then not even paying them a decent wage in the industry. We found in Palmdale that the Amazon doesn't even reimburse the DSPs for holiday pay. They tell them, yeah, give them these holidays, just five of them, and then they don't give them the ability to pay for the holiday pay. And so the contractor's got to figure out how to pull that out if they want to pay holiday pay. So Amazon, you know, prides themselves on saying all this different stuff, and it's pretty crazy. Another interesting statistic is out of those 84 drivers and dispatchers, only two of them were taking the health care. All these workers are flying without health care.
Just
can't afford it. And when you're making less than $20 an hour to do a job, that really should be paying somewhere in the high 20s, low 30s, even arguably in the high $30 an hour range, with very little benefits, you know, it's just an exploitive situation for some cheap stuff on Prime Day. What's the exchange? I think if the average person understood what the exchange was, they'd probably, you know, try to do something to help that workforce that's delivering to them.
Because I think everybody knows somebody who works in this industry. I know a couple of people who work at Amazon, and you know, we have conversations about you know, the environment, the wages, all of this stuff. And look, they all want to do better. They all want better wages, hours, conditions. But our labor laws are so badly broken and antiquated that, you know, nobody in that I've talked to believes that they've got an opportunity. They've got a shot. Now, look, I do see a lot of worker action going on, and that's a positive. But I think I would love to see more.
Well, I think you're going to see more. You're seeing just that over the last couple of weeks, you've seen extension of pickets out of Southern California. The Palmdale Group has landed in other parts of California. It's landed in New Jersey. It's landed in Boston. It's landed in Connecticut. And, you know, I'm hearing that there's probably more to come. And, you know, it goes to show it. And then what's incredible to watch, Rick, is these workers from Palmdale leading a picket line, you know, in another state or, you know, in another city. And when they're talking to volunteers or other workers in the industry and or the Amazon workers in a facility or the drivers that are delivering product, the common carriers that are coming in and delivering, you're seeing them get off the truck and grab a sign and walk the line with them. And it's because these workers are very articulate. They are very passionate about their position, and they're getting other workers to join them in this direct action in the industry, which is much needed. It is something that we really need to do more of. More workers need to do more of. And Rick, it is beautiful to watch, like Jesse, seeing him stand there and talk to 100 people that, you know, they're UPSers or they come from grocery or they come from other parts, you know, of the industry and other Amazon workers, just explaining what they're fighting for, what they're doing, what they're trying to accomplish, and just seeing workers come together and say, we're going to join you in this and walking off the job is incredibly powerful to watch.
No, I mean, we're in an important moment. I mean, especially coming out of the pandemic, when, as I said to earlier, you know, when these people were called heroes and essential and all of these things, and they got us through the pandemic only to find out that they're not making, you know, ends meet. They're not getting health insurance. They don't have health or retirement security. And the conditions that they labor under, deplorable. And in this day and age, it shouldn't be this way, especially when you're talking about a company as wildly profitable as Amazon.
Well, I think you're right. And I think one of the things you pointed out earlier is that the average person goes to work and sees the behemoth and the size in which Amazon is, and then they kind of start to think, well, it's impossible to take this on. But we see cities are rejecting them. We see, you know, municipalities are rejecting Amazon and their business model. We see workers are rejecting their business model. You know, obviously, you see all this activity and that this labor dispute that's happening coming out of 396 and Palmdale is directly at Amazon. It's not the subcontractor, because Amazon really appears to be the employer here with the amount of control that they have. Yeah. And what's happening is these workers are starting to connect to others, and they're starting to recognize, you know what, maybe we can do something about this. And, you know, Amazon wants it to, I guess, you know, corporate America and their beating down of the law that protects workers under the National Labor Relations Act. You know, the National Labor Relations Act, you and I have talked about this before, didn't happen until workers themselves took direct action and kind of shut down and really took control of certain industries and parts of industries. And then the Wagner Act was a peace agreement to settle that down. And at the end of the day, we got to kind of get back there again, because it doesn't appear as if any policymakers are going to help deal with this.
Yeah, there's no benevolence here. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Randy Corrigan. Randy's the Secretary, Treasurer, Principal Officer at Teamsters Local 1932. Teamsters1932.org is their website if you want to get any information on the work that they're doing, especially around Amazon. Because, you know, this is one of those moments where, you know, I'm hearing this and I'm seeing some of this, you know, what I'm actually seeing is corporate America trying to push back on it, because they know They've rigged the courts. They've rigged our politics. They've rigged the laws. Everything, see, the pendulum has swung to their side. The one thing they don't have is the empowerment piece of working people coming together. But I saw this sign, and I got to get your thought on this. And I saw this sign on the internet. It's supposedly the big giant M, the Golden Arch place. They're all over the place. Evidently, they posted a sign that said, "We value you, your growth, your contributions. This is a no-quit restaurant. Because we feel that many situations can be resolved, it is the policy of this restaurant that an employee cannot quit until he or she talks to the restaurant manager or area supervisor." And I'm going, you know, the only power workers really have is to fold their arms and march their feet. And they now want to take part of that away. And they have taken it away in other places. I see this getting much worse, but I want to get your thought on this.
Look, man, I think what it does is it identifies, you know, the origins of corporate America's problem in the United States going back to 1776. The reality is you have a huge corporation trying to take away someone's right to quit. Like, is that crazy? That is slavery. Like, let's open the door on that discussion. Go back to 1776 and recognize the fact that this country was formed based on a protest. But what they left out was the fact that you could own your labor. And they thought that that was okay for a long period of time. And the industrialists and the landowners and all the super wealthy at the time just, oh, no, this is okay. It's okay to do that. And you know what? The rules still haven't corrected themselves in America. They have still not worked themselves off of that original foundation from the founding fathers that most people want to prop up. And hey, look, they did some good things. But they also did some bad things. And some bad things were that you owned labor. All laws were built around the fact that you could own labor. And that has carried on generation after generation after generation. And you see a reemerging right there. Oh, let's take away someone's right to quit. Are you kidding me? It's crazy.
No, it's crazy. But, you know, I say all the time, they're heading us back to the days of the Lochner era, right, where, you know, if you're desperate enough and hungry enough to work in deplorable conditions for poverty wages, it's your freedom. It's your choice. It's your liberty, Randy. It's up to you. Even though we both know that, what choice do you have in a lot of these? I've been bringing up the fact that, you know, these forced arbitration clauses that people are forced to sign. Did you have a choice? No. If you didn't sign it, you didn't get the job. That's how they got you. These are the new yellow dog contracts of the past.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we can definitely beat this horse, you know, pretty hard over and over again. The reality is until workers take direct action and take control, it's that's where it's going to happen. If you look at anything in our history over our 247 years now, and you recognize, you have to recognize the fact that it's only been the movement of people that have marched in the streets or withheld their labor or have, you know, revolted in some way to say, hey, please pay attention to the subject, this issue, this culture, this challenge, that people wake up and go, oh, maybe we'll do something about it. None of this stuff has ever been handed to the American people, like by a group of corporate interests that say, oh, yeah, let's give them a holiday. Yeah. No, as a matter of fact, it's always been the opposite. They fought every single holiday along the way, but then they obviously, you know, commercialize every single holiday and try to make a ton of money on every bit of it. And then they don't even want to pay you for it.
No, I mean, the reality is it's the old saying, nothing's been given. Everything's been demanded. And you had to fight for all the things that we're given. There are no benevolent dictators. So last line of questioning I've got for you, you know, we're in stations all across the country. There are Amazon facilities all over these places. What's the word to those Amazon workers who are busting their behinds on Prime Day? And you know, for a lot of them, life isn't getting any better. What's the message for them?
Very simple. Put it down collectively. Set it down. Hold up your work for a certain period of time and demand that your supervisor or, you know, whoever's in control of your shop floor or your operation, pay attention to the issues and you articulate what those issues are. You put those demands clearly forward and you say, hey, we're not going to work until you make the adjustment, until you make the change. Workers are doing this all over the country right now. Amazon doesn't want to talk about it. Corporate America doesn't want to talk about it. The mainstream media is going to be very careful about how they talk about it because they're absolutely controlled by corporate America and they don't want these types of things to look successful even when they are. So what's the message to them? You can win. You can see over and over again where wages have been raised at these Amazon facilities where workers have come together and they've demanded more. You can see that their working conditions have been adjusted and changed and that Amazon has changed the policies specifically written, dealt with a response to workers pushing back. And you can actually take every one of those changes and reach it back to the specific area, whether it was in Minnesota or California or New York or Seattle or Chicago. Wherever those pushes happen from the workers, it changed the nationwide policy for Amazon workers. So they have to believe in themselves and believe in one another that it can happen no matter how much individuals will tell you it can't.
Yeah.
It can. And they have done it. And clearly, we've been a bit spoiled in this generation. If you look back to the 1920s and the 1930s, they had no laws, no protections. There was nothing in this space to help a worker. We may complain and we may not be happy with a lot of way it sits now. And we feel like a lot of this has been eroded, but it is better than it was when those workers, you know, had absolutely nothing and they had to tear at it. They had to tear at the industry or tear at their elected leaders or whatever they needed to do to gain some momentum. So we have to appreciate that. We have to recognize that, but we also have to not squander and waste the opportunity, capture it and move to action now. Put the work down.
There you go. Randy, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. Keep up the great work, and I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Absolutely. Anytime, Rick.
Our good friend Randy Corrigan. He is the Secretary of Treasury and Principal Officer at Teamsters Local 1932. Teamsters1932.org is the website. Check that out. You got questions, comments, something on your mind for him, you will find him there. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the day that the American Indian Movement began at a meeting in Minneapolis, Minnesota. A group of 200 Native Americans gathered together to discuss a response to the U.S. government's history of broken treaties and the devastating consequences on Native peoples. The statistics of unyielding poverty and high unemployment in Native communities were staggering. By 1970, 40% of the Native population lived in poverty. The unemployment rate was 10 times the national average. Life expectancy was only 44 years old. In the early 1970s, activists staged a series of occupations at Alcatraz, Wounded Knee, and at Mount Rushmore. Mount Rushmore is built on a site in the Black Hills that is sacred to the Ocheti Sakowin, or the Great Sioux Nation. The United States government promised Native rights to the land in a treaty that was broken when gold was discovered. In 1972, activists staged a Trail of Broken Treaties caravan, which ended in a six-day occupation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs offices in Washington, D.C. They issued a statement that read, quote, "We seek a new American majority, a majority that is not content merely to confirm itself by superiority of numbers, but which conscience is committed toward prevailing upon the public will in ceasing wrongs and doing right." Beginning in the 1970s, the United States government began to respond to Native people's demands. A series of federal acts gave Native communities more control over their education and improving their health care. Lawsuits brought by tribes resulted in further economic autonomy. Yet by 2014, one in four Native people still lived in poverty. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So here, who didn't see this coming? Evidently, a Michigan hair salon. citing the Supreme Court case that just said, hey, you know what, that website that nobody wanted, you don't have to make it for that gay person you didn't know. But evidently the hair salon has stated that they're no longer accepting LGBTQ customers. Evidently the woman who was in charge there called them pedophiles, compared them with animals, said they should be going to pet groomers. We told you, look, here's the thing. I've told you this isn't about cake. This isn't about websites. This is about power. This is about going after these folks and humiliating them. And look, not my issue, not my thing, but this is where you get my attention, because if it's these folks today, who is it tomorrow? When does it end? I mean, you know, the Pastor Niemöller quote, you know, first they came for the trade unionists and I said nothing because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews and I said nothing because I wasn't a Jew. And then they get down the list all the way down to then they came for me and there was nobody left to speak up. This is the kind of stuff that has to be squashed immediately. This is the kind of stuff that the fascistic right wing of this country is just salivating over. To be able to, well, punish the other and get their base all tingly in the panties and all worked up. And it's not just on this issue. There was a story in Nebraska. A woman in Nebraska, a mother pleaded guilty to giving her 17-year-old daughter a pill for an abortion last year. Then helped to dispose of the evidence because it's against the law in Nebraska. Thank you, U.S. Supreme Court. Now you have this woman who's pled guilty. Her daughter is also accused of a crime. They're going to end up in prison because of something that was legal 2 years ago. And, you know, the sad reality is, you know, we're going to see a lot more of this. We're going to see a lot more of these desperate situations of people doing desperate things when we've just got bad public policy. And, you know, I've come back to this story again and again, because the idea is it's not just about abortion. These people don't care about children. It's about control. They don't care about people at all. It's about power and control. Because here's the thing. If they really cared, if they really loved the children, if they really wanted the babies, other than for just cheap labor. You know, I still remember Tom DeLay going, you know, if abortion was illegal, we'd have those 40 million workers and we wouldn't need those people from Mexico, because we'd have tons of domestically grown cheap labor. But if... come with me, if you will, on this. Because if our pro-life folks really were pro-life, if they really, I mean, honestly, if they really cared, if they really, really, to their core, their sincerely held religious beliefs, they would have opened that book that they claim that they love so much, and they would have found a guy that they claim to love a lot, talking about feeding the hungry and taking care of the sick and the poor and the downtrodden. You would have seen policy coming out of states to ensure, I don't know, school lunch programs, school breakfast programs. You would see, you know, maybe programs to help, you know, low-income families, you know, get the health care that they need so that they can thrive. Maybe you would see, I don't know, education funding that would help, you know, families do better. Maybe you would see these policies, you know, work themselves out. Maybe you'd see this stuff being proposed. But what do I see? I'm looking at Iowa. I'm looking at Iowa and 15 other states who are trying to destroy child labor laws. We want to go back 100 years. Put the kids back in the mines and in the slaughterhouses. They got small hands, small bodies. They can fit in those tight spaces. It's really quite remarkable of what we've allowed to happen. And it's because the loud minority has continued to push this divisive stuff. Look, Are there things that I don't agree with every group? Yeah. But life, liberty, pursuit of happiness is like a central, it's like the North Star. And these people don't believe, well, they do. They believe in their happiness. And their happiness is telling you you're wrong. And that you need to be, you need adjustment. That you need to take care of yourself. So when I see these stories, and again, these are predictable. We knew this years ago. When Trump took office, we knew this stuff was coming. So when we see it happen, you go, here it is. Now you have to decide which side are you on. The classic labor frame. Which side? Which side of history will you be found on? This is the interesting thing. Most of the people that I know when I bring up CTE, you know, the theory about race that's critical, you know, that thing. One of the arguments that I get them to make eventually as we play through the song and dance that you have to get through is, well, their family, their tree, their lineage, their heritage is on the wrong side of history. And I believe mine was too. Here's the thing. I'm not them. I didn't do this stuff. We should correct it, make sure it never happens again, learn history. So that we don't make the same mistakes, so that we are on the right side of history, that when our children look back at us and go, you know what? They did the right thing. And I'm looking at where we are right now, and we're not doing the right thing. Just not. And I'm hoping the silent majority, I'm hoping the people who have sat out of elections, I'm hoping the people who've thrown up their hands and go, yeah, they're all the same. I'm hoping they come out to vote in 2024 in big numbers, because they're not all the same. Our Republican friends, they want power and control, and more than I'm willing to give them. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Lots of interesting news around the Trump trial. I've seen lots of tweets. I've seen lots of information. I've said from the beginning, and I'll stake my ground right here. I think Trump will be found guilty eventually. He's not going to jail. So the whole fantasy of he's going to be orange suited up and, you know, behind bars with a tin cup singing, oh, woe is me. I don't think that's ever going to happen. I also don't think there's going to be a trial before the election. Please just stop with all the, we got him. I'm not falling for the Mueller thing again. I'm not doing it, but here to share some thoughts on maybe what we can expect, some realistic ideas of what we can expect out of this trial. I've asked our good friend Renato Mariani to come talk with us. He's a former federal prosecutor, so he should know. I don't know, he's kind of done this stuff before. He should know better than the bubblegum lawyer on Twitter. He's also the host of It's Complicated podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find It's Complicated. Renato, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here, Rick.
So let's start right with this. Any chance that the trial is done before the election so that, you know, he's guilty before the election? Any chance of this?
No, because we just found out recently that Trump's team does not want that to happen. The only way this was going to go to trial before the election is if Trump's team wanted to have the trial before the election. And I'll just tell you that, and I know I'm going to get a lot of angry responses on this. Just to be crystal clear, that's not because it's Donald Trump. Rick, if you were indicted for some complex case with 400,000 documents in discovery involving classified documents, and you wanted to not have a trial before 2025, I'll tell you right now, we wouldn't have a trial before 2025. Like, that's not hard. It's not hard to delay in the federal criminal justice system when you have a very complex case. It's just the reality of how our system works.
No, look, I've known people who have had state charges, and it's been 3-4 years before they eventually went to trial. They just kept stalling and delaying. There are thousands of ways where a qualified lawyer, someone who knows how the system works, to slow the wheels down a little bit. Not that the wheels move all that fast in our justice system. But, you know, if you really wanted to throw a wrench into this system, yeah, there's a bunch of ways. No, I mean, you're the lawyer. There's a bunch.
100 different ways. And generally speaking, I mean, what's unusual about what Trump's team is doing is they're putting their cards on the table early. So typically, it's just sort of death by a thousand cuts, so to speak. You know, I have a case, for example, a big fraud case that was indicted in 2020. It's now mid-2023. It's likely going to get continued into 2024. That's just the reality of our judicial system, where there's a lot of people are backed up. You've got lawyers who have busy schedules and other trials. When there's voluminous discovery that gets produced over time by the government, everyone's got to review that. And defense attorneys, if they want to file motions, for example, they can delay things in that regard. Sometimes, for example, defendants fire their attorneys. I've had, when I was a federal prosecutor, I had one defendant fire four different attorneys in the same case to drag the case on for many years because he had figured out a way to escape from prison. True story. He did not want to change. He did not want to change facilities, so he kept firing his attorneys. He eventually escaped from prison like a week after I convicted him at trial because he had figured out how to keep him. You know, the way to keep yourself in the prison that was right next to the courthouse was to keep firing your attorneys and delaying your trial date. So it's really not hard to do. And, you know, as a practical matter, to me, this is not even really news. The only thing that's interesting about it is certain arguments they're making or the way they're doing it, which is kind of ham-handed.
So why is this going to get you any angry comments? I mean, everybody knows this, especially if you have money. I mean, this is, you know, we know there are two justice systems, one for the very wealthy and one for everybody else, especially the poor. So why would this revelation that I think everybody should have known already, why would this get you any angry comments?
I don't know. I've been fielding angry comments for the last like 48 hours or so, Rick. Lots of people, very vitriolic anger towards me. I think it's because people don't want, for example, when I tell them something they don't want to hear, they get upset at me. And I try to make sure people understand I didn't create the criminal justice system in the United States. I don't have the power to change it. It would be like really neat if I did, if I could create a system from scratch based on what I thought the justice would be. It would be a very different system. We'd spend a lot more time focusing on white collar crime instead of focusing on on sort of nonviolent, drug offenses, things like that. So I would have a very different criminal justice system, but the fact of the matter is this is the system we have. I'm describing it the way it is, and it is what it is. I said, Rick, right after Trump was charged, I wrote a column in Politico where I'm a columnist, and I said, he's not going to get tried before the election. And this was before any recent developments. It's common sense. Like if you actually have practiced federal criminal law, you know that that's going to happen.
No, I'm just a dumb truck driver. And I said the only way he gets this trial before the election is if he believes he can win. Otherwise, right, he's going to play the victim card as long as he can. He's going to play that out to the faithful base as long as he can. And if by some miracle he wins, can he then pardon himself? Because I said he'll just pardon himself. Can he, let's say he is, or does it just end? Does he put someone in the Department of Justice who said, no, we're not going to pursue this anymore?
Yeah, I mean, he could try to pardon himself. It's never happened where a president's pardoned himself. So who knows what would come of that, what the courts would think of that. You know, he could try to just shut down the Justice Department or put some stooge. Jeffrey Clark as Attorney General, right? Yeah. Who the heck knows? I mean, he certainly would have the power to do that. It would be very corrupt and it would be arguably whatever, some offense, but who's going to prosecute him for it? I mean, who knows what's going to happen? Obviously, frankly, our system of our constitutional system is over in that circumstance. But the reality is that is the stakes for the upcoming election. And that's why I'll just say, I mean, one message that I've probably said, Rick, because this is not my first rodeo when it comes to legal analysis. Okay, I've been doing... Ever since Trump got elected, I've been speaking out about abuses of power. I've been speaking out about, you know, the potential for the rule of law being, you know, ended in our country. And one thing I've always said to people is, please do not put your faith in a bunch of prosecutors in Washington or elsewhere to save America. OK, you have to get off your businesses and mobilize and save America yourselves. I mean, that's the reality of it. I felt the same way when Robert Mueller was supposedly going to indict him for some grand conspiracy with Putin. I thought that was absurd. And now this idea that, look, I thought he was going to be indicted for these documents because it was so obvious, but I don't care who you are. He didn't need to be Donald Trump. He could have been a 77-year-old truck driver. The bottom line is, if you're 77 years old or however old he is, 76 years old, you're going to delay. Like, why would you want to rush to a trial? So he's going to delay. And of course, you can do that in our system. It's just the reality of
that's the other part of it. No, I mean, he's a rich guy with money. He's an older guy. You could probably take this as long as he wants until he finally expires. But the other part of this, and you're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Renato Mariotti, former federal prosecutor and host of the It's Complicated podcast, wherever you find your podcasts. It's Complicated will be there. Hosted by our friend here, Renato. But there's a lot of thoughts that going around that this judge and this Aileen Cannon, who appointed by Trump, is going to pull some shenanigans. Do you have any concern about that?
Oh, for sure. I do. I mean, just to be clear, this is something I talked about a lot, and it's complicated. I think we did like an episode a few, several weeks ago about this, all the different ways you could tank the trial for Trump. Just to be clear, this is like not even the high on the list. I mean, she could literally, once the jury's impaneled, essentially grant a motion that would essentially end the case that's not reviewable by a court of appeals. So there's all sorts of ways she could tank the case. I will just say that this current motion in front of her, I think most judges, I don't know if they'd grant the motion. I mean, what most judges would do is they'd say, okay, I'll set a trial date for now, like let's say next summer, but I'll entertain any motions in the future to reconsider that and to move it, because we don't even know what the discovery is going to look like. The government has produced over 400,000 documents. They said they have more productions to come. You know, as things develop, as motions get filed, we'll move the trial date. That's probably what most judges would say. Or they'd say, we don't need to worry about this for now. Like, I'll push out, I'm going to take this under advisement and just deal with it later once they have more of a sense of things. But very, very few judges are going to be on board with Jack Smith trying to bulldoze the defendant into having a trial in like under a year over the objections of his attorneys, who are saying they don't have time to prepare and they have too many other cases in their docket and they can't review the documents and they can't file the motions. Like, he's not going to want no judge is going to want to try that case over and over again after appeals. So they're not going to do that.
Did you say 400,000 documents?
Yeah. And this is a classified documents case. So there's all sorts of extra BS that goes into discovery. And by the way, Trump's team hasn't asked for their own discovery yet. I mean, they're probably going to, I mean, if they're smart to slow things down, what they're going to do is they're going to make their own discovery request. They're going to ask for all sorts of other classified documents that the government doesn't want to give up and say that those are necessary for their defense. And those decisions are all going to be litigated out. It's going to take time. And by the way, under SIPA, which is the law that governs this classified document stuff, you can get an immediate appeal. So usually appeals are at the end of the case. You can have what's called an interlocutory appeal. You can go up immediately for appeal. So how many of those do you think there's going to be? I mean, as I said, you don't even need to be imaginative to figure out how this team is going to find ways to delay this. This case won't go to trial for a long time.
So let me ask you, the question on everyone's mind, does it ever happen? Does Trump ever step foot in a courtroom? Is he ever held accountable? Because, look, I mean, Exhibit A is him admitting that he had the classified documents. Him saying, yeah, I had the boxes. It was in the boxes. My stuff was in the boxes. You didn't think I was going to give you my stuff. My stuff was in those boxes. My stuff's more important than your stuff, you and your classified documents, that I'm allowed to have anyway. He admitted it. It's right there. It's cut and dry. Does he ever go to trial?
It's a great question. I think it depends on whether Aileen Cannon forces his hand on that. In other words, I mean, because he's old enough where he could try to run out the clock on, and not try out the clock, but just, keep going until he, whatever, passes away. I think it would, I mean, in a typical courtroom, and I practice currently as a defense attorney now all over the country, I would say in a typical courtroom, I would see, 3 or 4 years of delay in a case like this. Okay. 2 to 4, let's just say. And it depends on how fast the judge is. At a certain point, judge will just say, I've had a judge tell me earlier this year at a case, okay, Mr. Mariotti, we're going to trial. I understand that you, the speedy trial rights on your side, but we need to move this case. And we're going to go to trial this year. That's it. You know, ultimately, the Court of Appeals do not reverse trial judges on these sort of scheduling issues. And so he can, at a certain point, once he feels like I've had my chance to make my motions to get my discovery, they could do that. But in a case like this, it's so much discovery and so many issues and so complicated. And then you have the election. Are they really going to say we're going to have the trial in the middle of the Republican convention or in the middle of, 2 months before the election? Like, there's so many months and that are not even going to work next year, right? I mean, what are you going to really do this in November? Like, I mean, I just don't see that. Just don't see it.
No, it's never going to go to trial before the election because, as you pointed out, and so eloquently so, there are so many ways. 400,000 documents that they've already said there's probably more. Wow. Now my mind is maybe this never happens. I said he'll eventually be found guilty, but he's never going to jail. Now I'm reevaluating this all because you. Now I'm going to be angry. I got to reevaluate.
You can be angry at me. You can be angry at me like everyone else, Rick. But by the way, he does have other indictments. I mean, he's got the indictment in Manhattan, which is not a very strong case in comparison. Right. Okay, it's a much weaker case. That's the case you'd probably want to do first if you're in the Trump team because it's the weaker one. You know, that one's set for trial next year. That might get delayed. Who knows? I mean, a lot less complicated of a case. You got the Fulton County. He's probably going to get indicted there. He might get indicted in the January 6th thing. But, you know, the fact that he's indicted in multiple jurisdictions also gives him more reason to say he's overwhelmed, right? His team's overwhelmed and he's got all these different trials to schedule and juggle. I mean, he's in a very, very bad position, but you know, it's not like he's 23. Okay, right. He's what is he, 76 or something?
Like
he's
that.
Got yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't have a lot of time left. But here's the thing, out of all of this stuff, and this is kind of where I want to wrap this up. I mean, there's a lot. It's almost like he could have shot somebody on Fifth Avenue and gotten away with it. Because is he ever going to be held accountable for any of this stuff? I mean, because it seems like it's so much that it's almost like, well, yeah, okay.
You know, it's an interesting thing, Rick. I'll just say this from the experience of somebody who goes through this on a regular basis. For some of my clients, just getting indicted is just, it destroys their life, right? Their businesses go kaput. I've had multiple clients consider committing suicide. I've had their marriages get destroyed. I mean, so much happens to people when they get indicted.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that this guy is going to be indicted multiple times, already been indicted twice. That is a lot of more accountability than a lot of people see in this country. There's lots of white collar criminals out there who never get prosecuted because their case is too hard to prove. But yeah, I think, you know, will he get a conviction? Yes. The question is just when. If he becomes reelected as president, he may not get a federal conviction. And we are going to have way bigger problems on our hands than arguing about this criminal case if Donald Trump becomes the president again. So everyone listening to this might want to get off your butts and do something about that and do everything you can to make sure that we get Joe Biden reelected.
There you go. If you're that angry at Renato for coming out with the truth, maybe point that anger, that energy, that all that vitriol in a direction to ensure that he never becomes president again and is able to pardon himself. That seems logical to me. But Renato, as always, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. I look forward to seeing you in Chicago over the next couple of days at Netroots Nation.
All right. I'll be there. See you there.
Good stuff. Our good friend Renato Mariotti. I'm sure if you want to send him angry, angry stuff, you can find him on Twitter at Renato Mariotti. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come and talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the dumbest guy in the Senate started the day off kind of stupid. Evidently, according to ABC News, he tripped, didn't just double down on the belief that, you know, white nationalists shouldn't be called racist. He tripled down and took a lot of heat for it. Even Mitch McConnell jumped in and said, you know, white supremacy is simply unacceptable in the military and in our whole country. Because even Mitch gets it, knows that this isn't the hill you want to die on. Mitch understands you can be racist and homophobic and all of that stuff. Just admit, it's bad. You can be it, just it's bad. Tommy Tuberville just didn't want to do it. And then I guess eventually relented, eventually caved, and acknowledged to reporters on Capitol Hill, according to the Washington Post, that white nationalists are indeed racist. That was his view. Still hasn't done anything to undo the damage he's doing to our military by holding up, 250 promotions. We don't have a commandant of the Marine Corps right now. First time in 176 years. Thanks, dumb guy in the Senate. And speaking of dumb, Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, he's chosen Marjorie Trainwreck Greene as his pet project. You know, she got booted out of the Freedom Caucus, right? They were trying to contact her. She didn't answer the phone. But McCarthy said, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene is one of the best members we have. Really? You go in there? One of the best members he has. He says, I think she's one of the most conservative members and one of the strongest legislators. I support Marjorie Greene very strongly. He also went on to say, I don't know why they would do something like that from any perspective. I think it's a loss for the Freedom Caucus. Now, the most important person in the House, according to McCarthy there, wants to pull us out of NATO. Yeah, that's her. It's her thought. They're claiming they're not reliable. No, they're not reliable. Now, you think she's bad. Jim Jordan. Evidently, Jim Jordan wants to... remember, he's the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. He wants to move the FBI headquarters from Washington, D.C. And I got to think that I got a couple things. There's a couple of thoughts here. One, played the dartboard game. Just took a dart and said, you know what? There's the U.S. map. We're going to send the FBI to Huntsville, Alabama. Because that's where he wants to send it. And then my mind went, I've been to Huntsville. It's a lovely place. But not, somewhere that you'd want, if you're, someone who's used to Washington, D.C., probably not somewhere you'd want to go. So it's kind of, I think, a good way to, to clean out the FBI and get a bunch of crazy people like Jim Jordan. That's all I can come up with. That's the crux of it. And understand, you got the Jordans of the world, the Marjorie Greens of the world. You got these folks who... they want to tear down institutions. They want to tear down this country. And because they want to remake it in this place where money, power, control. They want draconian, Christian Sharia law where, heaven forbid you're different. They're coming for you. It's an interesting direction that we're going in this country because of these people. And the reason that these folks are in the positions that they're in is, you've got, massively gerrymandered districts where people like Green and people like Jordan are never going to lose. So they can be as crazy as they want to be. They can be as far out on the fringe as they want to be. They can propose the wildest most insane stuff. Let's put the FBI in Huntsville, Alabama. I think I'm going with the dart, though. I think I don't think he's smart enough to think of, you know, if we move to Alabama, nobody will go. I don't think that's it. I think it's a dart. I think it was the dart. And this is the thing that bothers me with where we are. You've got people who are not serious legislators. What are they doing? Honestly, you know, ask yourself this question. With all of the chaos coming out of Green and Jordan, McCarthy, and what have they proposed recently? What have they put forth that's going to make your life better? What have they put forth that's going to help put food on the table, keep a roof over your kid's head, make the job that you have better? What have they done? What has Donald Trump done to earn the loyalty, that the cult-like status that people have of him? That it doesn't, you know, I've had people tell me it doesn't matter what he's done. I don't care. He literally could have shot somebody on Fifth Avenue and they'd be okay with it. What have these people done other than, you know, push the hatred, push the division, make it okay to be deplorable? And not just make it okay, but make it a badge of honor. I've got people in my neighborhood with F. Biden flags flying from their flagpole. They don't have the American flag there. They got the F. Biden flag. What's wrong with these people?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So this should be an interesting conversation because evidently the Centrist Democrats of America, CDA, they have released a new survey here in my state of Pennsylvania that basically saying the majority of Pennsylvanians don't support increased funding for electric vehicles, that they believe that they should be going towards other priorities. I'm not quite so sure. So I thought be interesting to reach out to the founder and president of Lincoln Park Strategies, the folks behind this polling, and get some thoughts on it. That's why I've asked Stefan Hankin to come talk with us. He's the founder and president of Lincoln Park Strategies. Stefan, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So walk me through this. What's this poll? What's the argument?
Yeah, so the broader argument is that, or I'm going to put this into highlights, right? So voters in Pennsylvania and a bunch of other states where we did research, you know, very concerned about the environment. They're very concerned about gas prices and fuel prices. And then there is broad support for electric vehicles in the sort of the conceptual stage. But what voters are not getting behind is mandates that just outlaw the sales of, or getting rid of, gas cars. That you're just saying, like, in Pennsylvania you cannot sell gas cars after, you know, pick the date. And then, you know, and one of the bigger issues that a lot of voters have is that a lot of these laws are just being indexed to California law and sort of saying, well, whatever California does, we'll do. And, you know, really voters in every state where we did this research, and especially in Pennsylvania, are saying, like, look, Pennsylvania should write its own laws. Even if we support sort of the broader concept of moving towards EVs, let's go more in the approach of let's let the market go in the direction it's going versus putting a heavy hand on the scale.
And are they doing that in Pennsylvania? Did I miss the legislation that was going to end gas vehicles in my state? Did I miss that?
There, let me just double check. Like I said, we did this in a bunch of states. So what I believe is happening in Pennsylvania, and how far down the legislative path has gone, I am not an expert in that area. But what they're saying is let's try to peg our rules to what California is doing. California, I believe, has passed the law saying that after 20 2032,
35, I think.
No more gas vehicles being sold.
Right, in California, because they've got some serious air problems. And also, the industries, you know, are kind of moving in that direction, because that seems to be kind of the future. And I've got some problems with the way to get to the place. But I'm not against the idea of electric vehicles. I'm not against the idea of building some infrastructure. I think it could be very helpful for the working class to create the jobs of building that kind of infrastructure and give consumers choice. I mean, we talk about, you know, capitalism. You know, this is an opportunity to create that choice to give consumers the ability. No, I mean, because right now EVs are at a disadvantage because there really isn't an infrastructure to help them.
Exactly. And actually, what you've just said is where the plurality of Pennsylvania residents are, right? So 44% of voters in Pennsylvania say that, you know, the movement towards electric vehicles, it's already happening. You know, it might be a little slower than some of us kind of want, but like, let's just let the market do its thing. Most car companies have already said that they're, you know, by the mid 2030s, they're going to only be selling electric vehicles. So like, there's no point to put the heavy hand on the scale. And, you know, from a political standpoint, you know, I look at it and I say, it's like, look, we're already getting to the results that we want, right? And we being people who believe in electric vehicles, want to do everything we can to help the environment, try to reverse global climate change, et cetera. You know, so, but like, if we just turn this into a complete political issue, then we're likely to make things worse. So instead of going for the home run, let's hit four singles and get that run across the plate.
I don't disagree with you, but I'm my mindset has always been government procurement and government policy has pushed forward a lot of the things that we do, the automobile being one of them. We built a massive highway system. We've built, you know, refineries. We've given massive subsidies to oil companies. We destroyed public transit at the behest of oil companies. We've done all this to give the oil companies and the car manufacturers the kind of power that they enjoy. You know, it seems to me that government procurement could help us, you know, nudge in the other direction.
And I agree with that, right? And what we're also seeing, and again, I think, you know, voters are generally there, right? And then so, you know, we see that there's a pretty high level of support for the government getting involved in funding more infrastructure, right? So charging stations and making it so that, you know, people can use the cars in a way that they feel comfortable with. They can, you know, they don't have to wait a couple hours in line to charge up a car and things like that. So, you know, I think there are certainly ways that, you know, that the government can help move this along and move this along quicker. And we saw a lot of that in, you know, in the bill that Biden signed last year, where, you know, massive amounts of funding going into charging stations and getting that infrastructure set up. So, you know, from what we're seeing in the numbers, you know, it's saying like that's where the focus should be more than just going out for all out banning of the sale of cars, because again, it's just making it too much of a political hot potato that's just going to get into unnecessary fights.
No, I can see what you're. I see what you're saying. I mean, once we get into the red hat, blue hat stuff, progress gets shut down. You know, and I've been saying for a very long time, we need to put the red hats and the blue hats away, get a hard hat, and let's rebuild this country in a way that is going to leave our children something worth inheriting. And I think, you know, the way forward is, you know, public transit, electric alternative vehicles, you know, things like that. But I'm also a guy who loves my Jeep. I love my gas powered vehicles. I love my motorcycle. I love that stuff. I don't want to lose it. And I think that's where a lot of people have some fear. Do you agree?
Yeah, no, I think so. Right. I mean, like, look, change is difficult. Right. And if people feel like they're making the change, regardless of what it is, there's a much higher comfort level, right? So if people come to the idea of like, look, I'm going to buy the electric vehicle, that people feel are okay with that. If it's the government telling you to do something, you know, whether it's ultimately for good or not, you have a fairly large subset of the population that just doesn't like being told what to do, even if that's where they're going to end up anyway.
Right.
And, you know, looking at into some of the numbers, I mean, it, like, politics hasn't quite taken over this issue yet. So we asked about funding for charging stations, right? And Republicans, this one kind of surprised me, the largest group of Republicans feel that the federal government should be putting money into charging stations, followed by the funding feeling that private business should. They're not really on board with the state government putting much money into it. And actually, there's a higher percentage of Republicans, I mean, it's only by 1 point, than independents who feel that the government should be paying, the most into funding these charging stations. So, which is not sort of part of the normal talking point that you get out of the Republican Party.
No, the reality is that there's a lot of money in this system. The oil companies are making enormous amounts of money, off of, all kinds of, mineral depletions and all kinds of stuff. There could be a system where they transition over, and get away from, the dirty stuff and towards electric. And now, look, I've got problems with how we create electricity, and I'm hoping the technology gets better down the road. And look, I agree. Right now, I've had conversations around, EVs right now, because look, the average working family, they can't afford a new car, let alone an electric vehicle. They're trying to figure out how to keep their jalopy on the road. So I kind of get where this poll is coming from. So, in looking at these numbers, and again, I don't like being told what to do either, but I do want to leave something for my kids that's worth inheriting. So what do we glean from this? What do we get from this poll on how do we get to a place where we address climate and still address the needs and wants and hopes of the working class?
Right. And I sort of made this point earlier. But I think the big thing is, like, I mean, this is one of those, if you're looking at this with, sort of your progressive hat on, which I am, it's like, look, the goal is to get us to, as close to 100% electric vehicle as quickly as possible. Right. And, if we already have every major manufacturer saying that by 2032, 2035, each company is a little different, but like that they're going to be fully electric. If we see this level of support for just like we're fine with the market moving in that direction, right? It's like, look, we're heading towards the goal we want, and yes, sooner it would always be better, but if trying to make it sooner derails where we're going, it's not worth trying to get two quicker years out of it if we can get to where we want to be, in those mid 2030s. So, overall, from the progressive standpoint, I'm like, look, this is a win, right? Like, people are there, and it's just really the sort of the hardcore conservatives are just like,
well, you're never going to get
real. We don't need to do anything. Yeah, you're never going to get 100%.
No, you're never getting them. The red hats, the ones who are marching, you're not getting the most of them. For me, the idea of, again, I come back to leaving something for our children that's worth inheriting. I know my environmental listeners, their heads are exploding going, what, another 2 years before we get any action? Because we're told, and I don't, again, I'm not a scientist, but we're told, time is short because we've taken so long to get to this point.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think, the other thing is I think the reality is also that, we can't just flip the switch and tomorrow everyone has an electric vehicle, right? Like, just the infrastructure isn't there. The materials aren't there for the batteries. So yes, every year counts, but knowing how, especially Washington, works these days, right? To your point, if it's red hat versus blue hat, this just gets delayed even further and progress slows down. So in the Pennsylvania survey, we had close to 60% of residents across the state saying that they felt they were probably likely to buy an electric vehicle sometime in the next decade. Some sooner than others. And you made the point, right? I mean, when we asked people like why they didn't think they were going to buy an electric car sooner, the biggest reason that people from lower income households gave was that they're too expensive. So, costs are coming down. Let's all this stuff needs to happen for this really to be a robust system, but people are on board. So let's do those little things that just get it moving and making sure that we stay on this path versus trying to go bigger and derailing the progress we're making.
No, I'm with you, but I'm still in this spot where if it's not government procurement, if we're not investing in it, the private sector, the market isn't going to get there until there's that push forward. And I get what you're saying. I understand it, but I'm struggling with it.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, you know, if you got the magic wand and can make things happen, right?
Yeah.
Like get the money to go into the infrastructure, get those charging stations up and running, you know, get a lot more of them. And, you know, I think where the federal government can definitively be, the sort of the catalyst is what they do best, right? Is they're going to invest in research, right? So let's figure out that next generation of battery that uses materials that are less harmful, right? And certainly are easier to get out of the earth, or maybe even something that doesn't come out of the earth, right?
Yeah.
Let's come up with ways that we can get these cars up to, you know, 600, 700 miles on a charge. Let's get those batteries charging within, you know, 20 minutes. All things that, from what I can see, or what people feel they, you know, believe is possible is, you know, is there. So, you know, that's, if, you know, if I had my choice, like, that's where I'm telling the government to put their money. And I think a lot of that we did see, you know, in the deal that Manchin and lots of people came to that deal, but Manchin was the big one who made that happen in the Senate.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I'm at a point where, you know, look, we definitely need to be moving in that direction, and the sooner the better that we find alternatives and we make this better off. But I'm still in this mindset that, you know, we need, you know, something of a Manhattan Project kind of all hands on deck to move in this direction. But, you know, so last question I've got for you on this. So you know, if you're talking to the elected leaders in Pennsylvania across the state, then what do they focus on if you know, saving the planet and, you know, the environment and EVs and progress, what's the message then?
Yeah, I mean, I think personally, it's something around the fact of, like, look, we hear what the car companies are saying. We are glad they're heading in the direction of fully electric fleets in the next 10 years, give or take, right? The state of Pennsylvania is supportive of that. And we are going to start investing in the infrastructure needed. We're going to start putting more funding into some, you know, like, let's put funding into Carnegie Mellon, into Pitt, into Penn State, you know, Temple, whoever has the labs, the knowledge base to start, like, come up with the next battery, come up with solving some of these solutions, and, you know, let's make this happen, and let's make Pennsylvania the leader and show how this can be done.
No, I'm right there with you. So let me pull this back again, because the polling says we don't want to be moving in that direction. At least this is what I'm understanding. So you're saying we should be investing more in the technology and all this stuff, and doing that. And that's government investment. That's enormous amounts of money. How does that square with the poll?
I think that, I mean, this is what the polling is saying, right? What the polling is saying is the people are not on board with the government coming in and saying no more gas vehicles can be sold on this date. They don't like the overarching mandate of, you know, like, we are not, you know, we're not going to allow you to sell this thing. But they are fully on board with the movement to that,
okay,
that same point. They just want it to be more of a sort of a market solution, so to speak, versus the government saying this has to happen, even though it seems likely that it's going to end up in about the same point. So it's really more about the approach and the words and how you're getting there. But most people are on the side of let's get to that point, and you know, and we're behind that.
All right. Well, where do we find more information on this poll and the work that you guys are doing?
Our website is lpstrategies.com, and we have a bunch of the research up there. And if you Google around our name and centrist Democrats, you'll see a lot of releases of the various states and different information around the survey.
All right. Good stuff, Stefan. I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing some information. Glad you were here. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Stefan Hankin, founder and president of Lincoln Park Strategies, lpstrategies.com, the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith.
And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1892. Striking silver miners in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, blew up the Frisco Mill. The miners were upset because the company had hired Pinkerton guards to infiltrate the mine. Working conditions in the northern Idaho mining district were terrible at that time. Many workers were injured, and some died because of lack of mine safety. When mine owners wanted to purchase new equipment, they cut costs by increasing working hours and decreasing miners' pay. In response, the miners decided to strike. The mine owners, unsurprisingly, brought in scabs. Some scabs were persuaded to honor the strike. The mine owners also hired Pinkertons to infiltrate the ranks of the strikers. One Pinkerton, Charlie Shiringo, was so successful at gaining the confidence of the strikers that he became the union's recording secretary. The infiltrator had access to the union's financial records and relayed all information he uncovered to the mine owners. By early July, union miners suspected Shiringo was a spy. The miners became more militant, and in the very early hours, miners gathered to stop a trainload of scabs from entering the mine. Pinkerton guards were brought in to protect the incoming scabs. A shootout between the guards and the miners erupted. It was unclear who shot first, but the miners retaliated by dropping a box of powder down a flume in the Frisco Mill. The box exploded, and one company employee was killed. A battle broke out at a nearby mine, and three miners were killed before owners surrendered. Three mines fell into the hands of the workers by that evening. The governor of Idaho declared martial law and sent in the Idaho National Guard to break the union. These events helped to lead to the creation of the Western Federation of Miners.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So now look, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, the conversation I just had with Stephen Hankins. And, you know, look, I want to get us to a place where, you know, we have the ability to save the planet. You know, leave my children and grandchildren something worth inheriting. Look, we've seen the changes that are going on. Going to happen. Now again, you know, I'm told it's not man-made. I'm told, you know, some, not the majority, that, you know, none of this is going to work. It's all, you know, just, it's all ridiculous. Now, you know, we got to burn fossil fuels. And look, I don't think we're going to ever end the use of burning fossil fuels. I just don't. I don't think that's ever going to happen. But by moving in a direction that says, you know, we're going to build the infrastructure that is going to make it easier for people to buy EVs and bring the costs down by, you know, obviously producing millions of them, economies of scale. That makes sense to me. My problem is, and this is where, as a working person, I don't think we're doing what needs to be done to lay the groundwork to get us to the place where we want. And we haven't done it for decades. None of this is new. We haven't done the work in decades. And so I get what they're trying to say. You know, we can't speed this along. My mind goes into this place. We have been so negligent. Our politicians have been, you know, political malpractice to not deal with a central issue of the future of this country and of this planet. That I think we have to be realistic that there is so much. For instance, you know, I keep hearing, well, you know, we don't create enough electricity. I think we do. I think we squander it. Oh, what do you mean, Rick? What do you mean we squander? You know, are you one of those conservation guys? Yeah, somewhat, but not a lot. Ask my wife. I leave the lights on. Jerry Brown in 1992 ran for president under the idea that we're going to rewire the entire country. You know, we lose an enormous amount of electricity in transmission. I mean, the numbers, I've seen like 70% of what we produce is lost in transmission. We could, again, put people to work, good union jobs, restringing the entire country. you know, we're still on a, what, a 1950s, 1960s kind of grid? Maybe 70s? We could be upgrading, and we should have been upgrading. We should have been doing this stuff for decades. And now we're at this point to where the consequences are becoming real. Florida may be underwater in my lifetime. Or at least the bottom part of it. So for me, the idea of let the market decide is frustrating. Because I know that the market's always manipulated. You know, I think about how we got caught on gasoline motors, how we got caught on cars. We built a massive interstate system. You know, we could have built a massive rail system. We could have had public transit all across this country. But we made a policy choice to not. And the policy choice was purely military. You know, Eisenhower saw the Autobahn and said, hey, look how they can move missiles and stuff around. We need that. And the car companies, hey, we can crush that public transit that was successful in a lot of cities. Get people into cars. Do the advertising that freedom is your car. And we bought it hook, line, and sinker because we always do. We buy the Madison Avenue stuff. Look, I love my car as much as anybody else. I've driven millions of miles. I love driving. And also, I don't like being told what to do either. But there's a moment where you go, you know what? There's a direction we should be going as a country. Getting off of the dirty fossil fuels from countries that hate us. And I know the people, oh, we should be drilling here at home. Yeah, we're drilling. Not as much as some would like. There are leases out there that, you know, oil companies have been sitting on for decades. The oil companies don't want to drill. They don't want to increase supply. They're very happy gouging you at the pump. And my fear is, and this is where my problem with the electric vehicle comes in, my fear is we get gouged by the electric companies in the future because, again, we don't have visionary politicians who are moving us in a direction that is going to ensure that the working class of this country doesn't take it on the chin again. So do I understand the poll? I do. People are leery because we haven't had politicians who have sold it right, who haven't gone out and explained the vision for the future. We need better. I think Joe Biden's doing a great job, but we need better. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, I want to hear it. Also, miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. We will be in Chicago, Netroots Nation. Tomorrow, replaying our show from Erie. We'll see you on Thursday. Thanks for being here. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.